This is VOA News. I'm Jim Bertel. Hurricane Dorian is pounding the Bahamas with high winds, rain, and storm surge. National Hurricane Center specialist David Zielinski says whether the eye of the storm makes landfall in the U.S. or not, there's a good chance the East Coast will be affected.
Confidence is increasing that some effects will be affected or will be felt on the U.S. coast, regardless of whether or not the center actually makes landfall. And that's just because the tropical storm and hurricane conditions extend well out from the center of the storm.
The center predicts Dorian will move closer to Florida's east coast late Monday through Tuesday night. U.S. President Donald Trump's trade war with China is about to hit home. As of today, 69% of the consumer goods Americans buy from China will face his import taxes, up from 29%. AP's Charles de Ledesma has more.
The 15% U.S. taxes apply to about $112 billion worth of Chinese imports. While in China, authorities have begun charging higher tariffs on American imports, according to employees who answered the phone at customs offices in Beijing and the southern port of Guangzhou. Tariffs of between 5 and 10% are being applied to items ranging from frozen sweet corn and pork liver to marble and bicycle tires. A study by JP Morgan has found that Trump's tariffs will cost the average American household $1,000 a year. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is pledging to annex Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank. It was not immediately clear when Netanyahu plans to enact his sovereignty proposal. He pledged to make a similar move in April before Israel's general election, but never acted on it. Israelis go back to the polls later this month. From Washington, this is VOA News. The Taliban has launched an attack on a second Afghan city in 2 days, even as a ninth round of negotiations with the United States on ending the war wind down. Officials in Baghlan province said the insurgents were on the outskirts of the capital. A Taliban spokesman says its fighters stormed Afghan security posts and they are now inside the provincial capital. Saturday, the Taliban staged a large-scale pre-dawn attack on Kunduz, the capital of the province with the same name, from several different directions, triggering an intense day of gun battles with Afghan government forces. Texas police say the death toll from a mass shooting in the western part of the state Saturday has risen to at least 7. The gunman was also killed. Odessa Police Chief Michael Girk has called it a horrific day after the shooting deaths in Odessa and nearby Midland, Texas. Police say the incident started when a suspect hijacked a U.S. Postal Service mail vehicle, then drove around randomly firing at people. The shooter, described as a white male in his 30s, was shot and killed after being trapped by police in the parking lot of a movie theater. Shane Revels is an eyewitness.
You know, and I pray that those families that got injured or those individuals, they make it out. I got two little ones at home and I saw a little baby bleeding. So I don't know, boy or girl, don't know. And at that point, it doesn't matter. And I really hope that he or she recovers as well as the other individuals that were impacted by the situation.
Saturday's shooting comes after a mass shooting in early August at an El Paso, Texas Walmart, where many of the 22 victims were Hispanic. Pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong blocked roads near the city's international airport as part of another day of demonstrations Sunday. Some flights were canceled and authorities had suspended the express train service to the airport. Katya Woodham is one of the stranded tourists.
We were told that the trains are suspended at the moment and there are no other means of transportation. Taxis do not work, you know, our friends who can drive. Here they said roads are blocked, so it's really frustrating. We came all the way from London now. It was a long trip. My kids start their school tomorrow. We gotta go back home. We can't sleep here at the airport and we're very, very tired.
As Hong Kong surveyed a night of damage caused by government opponents, officials defended police actions as the city became a smoky battleground stoked by young people battling for democratic change. The International Committee of the Red Cross says more than 100 people are believed to be dead after the Saudi-led coalition fighting Iran-backed Houthi rebels launched an airstrike on a detention center in southwestern Yemen. A Red Cross official says teams are working to find survivors under the rubble. For more news whenever you need it, please visit us at voanews.com. I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
The government of Malawi does not perpetrate violence in any form. As a matter of fact, we have issued a statement condemning any form of violence against any person.
Malawian Information Minister denies accusation the government is behind the attacks against prominent activists.
We are prepared. The preparation for elections, they don't usually come as a surprise because we have a timetable. Even if we finish elections tomorrow or on the 23rd of October, we are sure when we are going to have another election. The necessary preparation will start as early as that.
The Botswana Electoral Commission says it will be ready to organize the October 23 polls.
I have been targeted by this government with a lot of trumped up charges. In the last 2 years, when I declared war against corruption, I've been arrested 9 times. And every time they arrest me, they deny me police bonds until I go to court to get bail.
And a former Zambian information minister says he will keep on fighting against corruption in the Southern African country. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Malawian Information Minister sharply denies accusations the government is behind attacks on human rights activists who have been organizing a series of protests against the administration. Mark Botomani says the administration is committed to protecting life and property as enshrined in the Constitution. His remarks came after petrol bombs were allegedly hurled at the homes of Timothy Mtambo, leader of the Human Rights Defenders Forum, or HRDC. Malawian Information Minister Mark Botomani tells me the government is waiting for the conclusion of the policy inquiry into the alleged attacks on the activists to determine the next line of action.
That is completely false, and the accusations are actually unfounded because the government, especially the government of Malawi, does not perpetrate violence in any form. As a matter of fact, we have issued a statement, and I think that was last week, we issued a statement condemning any form of violence against any person, be it a human rights person or any government official, anybody else, with regard to petrol bombing. And so to say that government is perpetrating this kind of violences is completely unfounded, and it has no, the accusations have no basis at all.
They are of the view that the government has yet to launch an independent investigation to determine who are behind it. And secondly, the police, who are supposed to enforce the law, are also dismissing this. And that the government is also saying that this seemed to be stage managed to get sympathy. So the situation is really confusing. Who is right and who is wrong? The government has a constitutional mandate to protect life and property of Malawians, critics say. How do you respond to that?
I would like to agree with you that the government has the constitutional mandate to protect the lives and property of people, and that is true. But on the issue of instituting investigations, I think they are saying that the government is mute on that. They are telling a lie because for all we know, the Malawi Police Service, they came out immediately these issues started occurring to say that they have actually instituted investigations to look into these issues. And what we're doing now is just to wait for the police service to conclude their investigations and indeed to apprehend the people that are involved in this kind of barbaric acts. That's our position.
But how about the issue that the police and some government officials telling these gentlemen who have come under attack that they stage manage this just to gain sympathy, and that this probably might have been supporters of the HRDC or the opposition, so that these two leaders would seek asylum abroad? Why are government officials saying so?
Well, I must say that as a government spokesperson, I haven't seen any official communication from government that suggests that these acts, you know, being perpetrated by themselves. Maybe they are stage managing these things. But you know, people suspect. You know, and you cannot you know, prevent people from suspecting that that could be true, because a lot of things, the way they are happening, it's quite suspicious. But we do not have an official position with regard to those sentiments that are expressed by the general public.
So far, how has been the supposed dialogue between the HRDC, the group that has been organizing a series of demonstrations, with the Attorney General? And secondly, why is the government not meeting them to address their concerns, which they said is the fact that the chairperson of the Malawi Electoral Commission bungled the elections, the outcome of which is being challenged in court currently? Why wouldn't you meet them to address their concern?
To answer your first questions, the dialogue process has started. I think the first meeting was convened on Friday. And for what we have heard is that there's going to be another meeting soon in order to come to terms, you know, with regard to the order that was given by the Supreme Court of Malawi. Now, in terms of your second question, I think we have the position, and we still have it, that the issues to do with Justice Dr. Jane Ansah, the current chairperson of Malawi Electoral Commission, are issues to do with elections. And for all we know as government, is that matters to do with elections are in the courts of law. And so all we do is to wait for the verdict that will come out from the courts after hearing both parties. So we are not commenting on issues that are in courts, especially to do with Dr. Jane Ansah right now.
Mark Botomani is the Malawian Information Minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. The spokesperson for the Botswana Independent Electoral Commission says the poll group will be ready to organize and administer credible elections on October 23. Osupile Maroba says the electoral body has been meeting political parties and other stakeholders in readiness for next month's elections. His comments came after President Mokgweetsi Masisi officially issued writs Friday, ordering the Independent Electoral Commission to organize polls on October 23. Electoral Commission spokesperson Osupile Maroba tells me the poll organization will begin accepting nomination of candidates beginning September 26 ahead of the polls.
We have long started preparing for these elections as far back as 2016, looking into some of the legal framework that needed to be amended. And from last year, 2018, we started registering citizens both locally and internationally for them to prepare for these elections. And as a matter of fact, implementation of the legal framework or the rule of law, the Constitution so empowers the president that towards the end of the electoral cycle, and as soon as Parliament finishes its last sitting of the fifth year, the president has to dissolve Parliament. And thereafter, the Constitution further empowers the president to issue a writ of elections. The dissolution took place on Wednesday, the 28th, midnight of August.
Yes. Yes. So talk to me about the nomination of candidate, which you have, I think the Electoral Commission has scheduled it for September 26th.
Yes. The writ that is issued by the president has both dates. It has the date for the nomination of candidates for the National Assembly and the local government. Now, the situation is that during that time, we expect those candidates who have won their primary elections in their respective political parties, which are not part of it, and those that who are wishing to stand as independent candidates to come and register with the Electoral Commission, because we need to have their symbols and voting colors for the production of ballot papers. Now, that date is part of the date that is being issued through the writ. and the election instruments.
How prepared will the Independent Electoral Commission be due to what some people say will be a highly contested election on all fronts?
Yes, we are prepared. I want to say that the preparations for elections, they don't usually come as a surprise because we have a timetable. Even if we finish elections tomorrow or on the 23rd of October, we are sure when we are going to have another election. So the preparation, the necessary preparation will start as early as that. Now, this time around is just to now do the paying up the loose ends, making sure that where we are, nothing remains behind. We have done everything that we need to do by now for us to be able to say, come October 23rd of October, we'll be ready to conduct elections. And there is nothing so far that went to the contrary. We are all set and ready to conduct these elections.
What about coordinating with political parties as part of the transparency process to ensure transparency and credibility of the electoral process?
Yes. Even just to say that even yesterday, we had the last meeting with all the prospective candidates. We either from political parties, their agents, or independent candidates, we were discussing the requirement of the law in preparation for them to submit their names on the 26th of September 2019. It's a process. We are in democracy. Consultation is the basis for any democracy. They know that we can go into election, leaving the political parties or primary stakeholders in the back. We are in touch with them. Like I'm saying, we have just consulted all the prospective candidates, the whole country, in preparation for this nomination day.
How about voter education across the country in anticipation of the election and the prospective voters?
We have established collaborations with quite a number of civil society organizations, from the youth, people living with disability, women, faith-based organizations, and we are in continuous contact to conduct voter education. We have a special unit within the organization, but as I'm speaking to you, they are traversing the country to conduct civic and voter education in preparation for this poll.
Osupele Maroba is the spokesperson for the Botswana Independent Electoral Commission. He spoke with me from the capital, Habaroni. Former Zambian Information Minister says he will not be deterred in his commitment to the fight against corruption. Tshishimba Kambwili, leader of the opposition National Democratic Congress, or NDC, says no amount of jail time or attempts to suppress his constitutionally guaranteed freedom of speech will prevent him from speaking truth to power. His comments follow his release after he was granted bail ahead of his trial scheduled for September 13. Kambwili is charged with defaming President Edgar Lungu over allegations he referred to the country's leader as a dog. Kambwili tells me there is need for an international intervention to ensure the Zambian public purse is protected.
Since I started the anti-corruption crusade and talking about the wrong things that government is doing, particularly in the procurement of works for roads and infrastructure, where there is a lot of massive corruption, I have been targeted by this government with a lot of trumped-up charges. In the last 2 years, when I declared war against corruption, I've been arrested 9 times. And every time they arrest me, they deny me police bond until I go to court to get a bail. On 2 occasions, they've entered a nolle prosequi on trumped-up charges that they've arrested me on. Now, this is getting out of hand. They want to stifle divergent views. They don't want people to exercise their right of expression enshrined in our constitution. This government has become very unreasonable and intolerant. And the reason is very simple. It's because there's a lot of corruption and they want to silence everybody. But me, I'm not a person who can be intimidated. I am ready to die for speaking the truth and for telling these people to do the right thing.
some people are saying you should change your strategy of fighting against corruption, and that there are some people in Zambia fighting corruption the same way, but they are not using the strategy you are embarking upon. How do you respond to them?
Which strategy? All I do is I talk about corruption and condemn it. And whoever is perceived to be a thief, I call them thief. And if it calling people thieves is an offense, then I'm 100% guilty.
So where does the fight against corruption leave you now? Because you are facing charges, and some people are even speculating that you could be thrown in jail for defaming the president. And that is why they are saying perhaps you should change the approach. How do you respond to that?
My brother, I will not relent on the fight against corruption. And like I've told you, for me, I believe in calling a spade and not a spade a pick for the sake of impressions. I will speak my mind out. If it means going to jail 50 times, I'm prepared to do that. These people must stop stealing. These people must start caring about the people of Zambia. These people must stop corruption. And as long as there is corruption, I will not relent in speaking the way I speak, because that's who I am.
Now, some supporters of the ruling Patriotic Front Party are saying you keep on saying officials in the administration are corrupt, yet you are yet to provide any empirical proof, which the president himself has said if anybody has proof, should present it, and that his administration is open for investigation to punish anybody who has engaged him or herself in act of corruption. So why aren't you providing the proof?
My brother, we provide a lot of evidence of corruption. For instance, I'll give you an example. They procured fire tenders, ordinary and very cheap fire tenders at $1 million each. The young brother of the minister of local government who was in charge of that procurement was bought a truck, a 30-tonner truck. The minister was given three vehicles, a Range Rover, a VX, Toyota VX, Land Cruiser, and a Ford Ranger. I provided all the evidence. If you go to the road traffic agents where records are kept for people who own vehicles, you'd find the record is there. Nothing was done about it. When you report corruption under this administration, the anti-corruption, the police are threatened, and they can't take any action. So to report these issues to the police or the anti-corruption is a sheer waste of time. Can you believe that there are some 48 houses which were built out of corrupt money? The anti-corruption are saying they are not able to trace who is the owner of the 48 houses. Can't you see that's the biggest joke of the year?
So what is next for the case against you, of which you were just granted bail? What's next?
I'll be going to trial on the 13th of September. We are appealing to the international community to come in and help us fight this and becoming corruption. You know, we have tried what we can as Zambians, but it appears that this government is very arrogant. So we are calling upon the international community to come in and add their voice to the undemocratic tendency of President Edgar Lungu and, of course, the corruption that is going on in this country. Because even donor money that is given, you heard what happened on the social cash transfer, money that came from the British and others, it ended up in people's pockets. So we want the international community to voice out and tell Lungu that he cannot behave like Mugabe.
Chishimba Kambwili is a former Zambian information minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. Meanwhile, the chairperson of the Zambian Council of NGOs says Nonde Chanda, the leader of the NGO registration board, is violating the constitution by threatening to deregister civil society organizations who fail to adhere to guidelines governing them. Nonde warned the NGOs to limit their work by providing civic education and awareness regarding the ongoing constitutional amendment process. But Chairperson MacDonald Chipenzi tells me Nonde was wrong to admonish the NGO, saying he does not have the power to deregister any member of the group.
We find this warning as utter horror and empty, in the sense that there are no bases on which to deregister NGOs just because they have taken a position on a national matter. When the Constitution of the Republic clearly gives them that freedom to hold an opinion, and to impart that opinion to the people or a class of people or to a person without any interference. So we find that those warnings as unconstitutional and a clear violation of the supreme law of the land.
But he is of the view that you are imposing your will and decisions on the people of the Zambia. And he thinks that you should give the information and educate them and let them make their own mind, which they said is what is required of your work, which is stipulated. And that imposing your will or your decisions on Zambians goes against the guidelines under which you are established.
Unless you have cited the law or a section within the act of which he is using, that it dictates that civil society or NGOs should only do civic education and should not hold an opinion or indeed impose an opinion on the public. And he should also be able to explain what does he mean by imposition. Is it an imposition to say this is our position and it's up to the people to follow that position? If that is an imposition, yes, many NGOs have imposed their opinion. But of course, it's not that when I have an opinion or I hold a strong opinion, it's the same opinion that other people hold, even in the community. There are those who disagree with me and agree with me.
Well, he's also of the view that some NGOs and civil society organizations, so to speak, have become political players or basically becoming opposition parties in name and in practice instead of just staying true to what you are established to do. Your response to that?
Actually, the same Nonde was appointed because of being a politician. He was one of those that was very close to the ruling party, and he was appointed chairperson of the registration board based on that criteria. So in the first place is that himself is purely a politician, and he has associated himself with those NGOs that are frequenting the corridors of power. And whatever imposition they would want to impose or their opinion he is comfortable with, but would quickly try to censure those NGOs that would have carried the contrary view. We find that one, that kind of behavior as hypocritical and purely meant to dictate opinion rather than to allow opinion to flow the way they are supposed to flow in a democratic society like Zambia.
You are of the view that he does not have the power to deregister any non-governmental organizations. He says the board has the power to deregister any organization that goes or works outside or contrary to the established guidelines. How do you respond to that?
One fact that perhaps Mr. Nonde has ignored is that not all NGOs registered under the NGO registration board or by the NGO registration board. Actually, most of us are not registered under that NGO board because we have contested the NGO Act number 16 of 2009 as being repugnant to the democratic existence of NGOs. Out of benevolence from the NGOs and also the Attorney General then, we decided to withdraw the case so that we repeal and replace the NGO Act. As we are talking now, the registration under the NGO Act is not mandatory. Most of our NGOs, ourselves, for example, we are not registered under the NGO Act. We are registered under other regulatory frameworks.
McDonald Chipenzi is the chairperson of the Zambian Council of NGOs. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, a lack of infrastructure and education surrounding proper waste disposal in the Senegalese capital of Dakar has resulted in piles of litter inundating the city's streets and beaches. One business owner is taking matters into his own hands by turning his restaurant into a waste-free haven. It's the first of its kind in the region. For VOA, Annika Hammerschlag reports from the Senegalese capital, Dakar.
Plastic bags, bottles, cigarette butts, and other debris lap against the shore of Village Beach in northwest Dakar. Workers from beachside restaurants and surf shops rake the sand to try to capture the waste, but the garbage always returns. Babacar Tia is the owner of Copacabana Surf Village, a surf shop and restaurant on Village Beach that was opened in 1970 by Tia's father. Despite shopkeepers' best efforts to keep the beach clean, it's never enough.
Growing up here, I see all this problem that the environment is facing with the trash. People are just throwing. And this idea for me to get the transition of the restaurant Zero Waste came from a long time ago, since I was a kid.
Cha has spent the past year working with local conservation groups, transitioning his business into a zero waste restaurant to set an example. It's a radical idea in a country where the typical person uses multiple plastic cups throughout the day to drink tea and consumes water in small plastic sachets. Despite having a relatively small population of 15 million, Senegal is one of the world's largest contributors to plastic pollution. A 2010 study by the journal Science estimated the country produced more than 254,000 tons of mismanaged plastic waste that year, making it 21st in the world in annual plastic mismanagement. At the official launch of Cha's newly transitioned restaurant, attendees could read any of the roughly dozen plaques that describe the steps Copacabana has taken to reduce waste. Plastic straws were abandoned in favor of those made from metal and bamboo, and a refillable water jug had replaced the 100 bottles customers used to consume each week. The restaurant also switched from disposable napkins to reusable fabric, and instead of cleaning with harmful chemicals, they used natural soaps and vinegar. Leftover food is composted. Copacabana also eliminated its single-use pods to make coffee.
Because I feel like it's our duty to do that. If we don't do it, no one will do it for us. Government are here. They're always talking. We never seen something done. No one going to save us if we're not doing it by ourselves.
Senegal banned plastic bags in 2015, but the law was never put into effect. Claire Stragier is a project manager for Make Sense, an organization that works with governments and businesses around the world to help them lower their environmental footprint. The group helped Cha create an action plan for his transition to zero waste. Stragier said, foremost, the waste problem in Dakar is due to a lack of infrastructure. There's almost no public garbage cans, and the few that exist are never emptied. Secondly, she said, is a lack of awareness among residents. She says there's clearly a lack of education among Senegalese people and that they don't know the impact of throwing plastic on the ground. They don't know that the plastic will stay there for more than 40 or 50 years and that it will have a very negative impact on the environment. Astu Boyjan works on the other end of Village Beach at the restaurant Chez Paco. She said she appreciates Cha's initiative and hopes her restaurant will make similar changes. She says the zero waste efforts inspire her because it can make beachgoers more aware that it's forbidden to throw their trash everywhere. And that's a good thing. While Village Beach struggles with plastic pollution, it's in much better shape than many other beaches in Dakar. About 5 kilometers west is the fisherman's neighborhood of Yaf, where Cha grew up surfing. The beach there is so badly littered with plastic that surfers often pedal through hordes of it in order to reach the waves. Cha refuses to surf there anymore.
Yaf, oh my God, that's my village. I'm born in Yaf and raised in Yaf, but I can't stand it like about that. I can't like, this is a big pity, you know, because people don't realize, even or they realize, but it's just like something normal for them. If you keep doing this, in 10 or 20 years, we're gonna have a trash ocean.
Annika Hammerschlag for VOA News, Dakar.
And a global fund for education in emergencies is seeking $1.8 million by 2021 to provide schooling for 9 million children and youths caught up in conflict and other crises. The fund, called Education Cannot Wait, was set up at the World Humanitarian Summit in 2016 to provide education for children deprived of this opportunity. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The fund has raised $500 million since it began operating in 2017. In its first 2 years, it has provided emergency education for more than 1.5 million young people caught in armed conflict, forced displacement, natural disasters, and other crises in 29 countries. Director of Education Cannot Wait, Yasmin Sharif, says significant investments are being made in the Sahel, in countries such as Burkina Faso and Niger, where the needs are among the greatest on earth. She says children in Cameroon have not gone to school for 2 years as a part of a tactic of war. She tells VOA education is specifically designed to deal with the suffering experienced by children caught in armed conflict, all of whom are seriously traumatized.
So quality education requires mental health and psychosocial services. That's number one. And that is one of our absolute top priorities. Two, it requires inclusiveness and gender equality to ensure that every girl is put at the forefront, that they are no left the furthest behind of all those who are left furthest behind.
Sharif says the fund is working with the government of Afghanistan to bring girls back to school. She says displaced children in Democratic Republic of Congo are being provided with an education now, so they do not have to wait until the conflict ends. A recent report by the UN Refugee Agency finds half of the more than 7 million refugee children in the world do not go to school. Sharif says almost 50% of the fund's beneficiaries are girls. She says 46% are refugee and displaced youngsters, and 14,000 are children with disabilities. She says children who go to school are inoculated against many dangers. She says those who do not have access to education are at high risk of exploitation and abuse, sexual violence, early marriage and pregnancies, and forced recruitment by armed groups. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with football. Burkina Faso beat Nigeria 2-0 in the final of the 12th African Games Rabat 2019 on Friday at the Stade Babuka Ama to win gold for the first time. Les Etalons scored twice in the first half, thanks to Jibril Quattara and Ismahia Quedrago. The two teams had already met during the first day of the group stage when they ended with a 1-1 draw. Early on Thursday, Senegal beat Mali 4-3 on penalties to win bronze. And South Africa has named Molefi Nseki as their new coach following the departure of Stuart Baxter. The decision was made on Saturday at the South African Football Association Council meeting in Johannesburg. The 50-year-old Nseki is the coach of the country's under-17 team and was Baxter's assistant at the Africa Cup of Nations in Egypt in June. He also worked as an assistant to previous national coaches Sheikh Mashaba and Owen Dagama. Before that, he was an assistant coach at Bloemfontein Celtic in the country's professional league, but has never been in charge of a senior team. Nseki, who did not play at professional level, was a teacher before turning to full-time coaching some 20 years ago. In Uganda, a coach's passion for baseball is getting schools to embrace America's favorite pastime. But a lack of government support means baseball in Uganda is heavily dependent on donations. Halima Athman reports from Kampala.
George Wilson Mukwege has worked as a baseball coach in Uganda for the last decade and for the last 3 years as a Major League Baseball scout in Africa. He says there is impressive talent in Kenya, South Africa, Tanzania, and Uganda. But Mukobe says few sports shops sell baseball equipment and there is a lack of facilities and support.
Baseball faces a big challenge because since people have little knowledge about baseball and it's a damn expensive game, they say maybe next time, you know. They run for quick sports like soccer and athletics and volleyball, you know, basketball. But with baseball, it's really tough. Even the coaches themselves also. You need to have enough knowledge to convince the kid that, yes, you know the game, so that you can teach them.
Uganda's baseball players are heavily dependent on donations from the US and Japan, where Americans introduced the sport. Uganda's National Council of Sports says baseball is not among their priorities. Ismail Chigongo Dakala is the council's spokesperson.
One of the things that lacks currently that you could think that they could do much better, baseball and as government, is to give the team the chance to compete. Today, they only compete largely against Kenya, Nigeria, Ghana, and South Africa. So maybe if there were many more countries competing, they would raise the kind of awareness.
Despite the limitations, baseball has come a long way in Uganda. In 2012, Uganda became the first African country to play in the Little League Baseball World Series in Pennsylvania. America's favorite pastime is attracting Ugandan converts such as 21-year-old Arago David, who plays for Uganda's national team and is an assistant coach.
First day I came, they told me, you have a glove, this is a bat, baseball. I said, I'll try it and see. When I trained for a month, they called me and said, you know what? We are taking you to the national team. Under 12, I said, okay.
In May, Uganda's national team came in second after the host at the Olympics pre-qualifier in South Africa. The success of Ugandan baseball is inspiring more players. 15-year-old Wenene Specialza became a fan after watching boys play and decided she too could play baseball.
I know what I want, the coach loves me, and I got interested in my first base because I play first base. It's so interesting if you get to know him, really.
No, don't play! Start on the beach!
While Ugandan baseball looks for more support, its young players will depend on coaches like Mukobe to take them out to the ball game. Halima Afmani for VA News, Kampala.
And in boxing, Vasyl Lomachenko produced a battling display to beat Britain's Luke Combo on points and add the WBC lightweight title to his WBA and WBO belts. The 31 Lomachenko, regarded as one of the best pound-for-pound boxers, was made to work hard for the thrilling win. Combo, also 31, was aiming to become a world champion for the first time, but was floored in the 11th as the Ukrainian's class proved decisive. Combo, an Olympic gold medalist in 2012, suffered the third loss of his 23-fight professional career. In athletics, Uganda's long-distance runner Joshua Cheptegei sprinted to a memorable win and set a new personal best in the men's 5,000 meters in Zurich, Switzerland, on Thursday night. Cheptegei finished the race in a record time of 12:57.41 at the IAAF Diamond League. Ethiopia's Hegos Gebhewet was second, with favorite Yomif Kajelsha only managing sixth. The 22nd-year-old reigning world cross-country champion, Cheptegei now has his sights set on World Athletics Championships in Doha, Qatar. Finally, Caster Semenya will not defend her world 800-meters title in Doha in September after a Swiss judge overruled a temporary suspension on the IAAF's controversial testosterone cabin rules. The ruling means the 28-year-old can no longer compete in events between the 400 meters and a mile, as she did in June and July. The World Championships are scheduled between September 28th to October 6th in the Qatari capital. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect
A flashback with music from the continent. And you are hearing from Diamond Platinum with Utani Penda. Then Bobby Wine follows with Afandi. Zani Brown comes in third with Bayeye. And then Edith Yahweh comes in with Tukagali. Meneja umebaki jina nitakia tatale. Ole shabiki zangu waloni sifu kwa maneno matamu. Leo matu zangu ni mitu situ kwa Instagramu. Kimwa na statangu eti na ya nifamu. Hata muna izi kimpigia ananifukia kama salamu. Na magazeti nyumbani kwa kukusa bali sunajuaga. Sikia tafarani timoni kwa zari amemwagwa. Na venye nilivyo nyonge tabia ya kwa jibu sinaga. Kama naiona michambo ya matemu wa zamani nopitiaga. Nayosema ya ramana sababu hakuna anejua kesho. Anepanga ni ravana ila meficha ni confidential. Ukisaliomba sana mumeo nisije kwa kichekesho. Mana rafiki wa jana ndio adui mkubwa kesho.
Afande sirwana na wibe, manirira kwe, Ivana niwe mukagwana nirira iwe afande sipigani nawe nakupigania sipigani nawe lakini nakupigania afande sirwana nawe be nanirira kwe Ivana niwe mukagwana nirira iwe afande patyalwe ntedi afande atyalwe mpiri ingoi goya goya balabela duini nini ni afande chana Chote unafanya, kuna wakati wakulipa Chote unapanda, diyo utafuna Banji babandeo, ngakwe boliwo Wewe wale sobiza bubola buse Afande sipigani nawe, nakupigania Sipigani nawe, lakini nakupigania Afande sirwana nawe, be, nanirira kwe Tiwana niwe, mukagwana nanirira iwe Masikini, hatoki alika ni mama inji ya pole Why? Wadoba kubira girona ena uli mtu Embele zitunyika, na weze zikunyika Osula bobe, ofona bobe, na bantu bona bobali bobe Menyoge la Kongo, neme la kona, yenga chichenju Afande sipigani nawe, nakupigania Sipigani nawe, lakini nakupigania Afande sirwana nawe, be, nanirira kwe Tiwana niwe, mukagwana nanirira iwe Afande sipigani nawe, nakupigania Sipigani nawe, lakini nakupigania Afande sirwana nawe, be, nanirira kwe Tiwana niwe, mukagwana nanirira iwe
Bobanga bobola bira komu yaye era nabo fuka muyaye Mwe babanga bakulembese bayaye nabatuze bayaye Yasali wa mukabuka kebunaira Na kula nempisa Ngabulita taweza mugamba mukondera Ngaya mugamba tiye takula biashi kwangala Ngaya mugana evyo kurana Ngabumu kubetama akuchusi zadara Naya ukana nyo kubabubu kabalala Ngaya mugana bawali nguli nenjaga Teyamanya Choruso mwana omuntu byakugana seyabikola Tatawe bamukwasa nakawala Ngabatunde njaga Tetechali na tata kwasa muchitibwa Yafuka muyaye nenjaye katyajinywa
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The Japan-Africa high-level meeting was held last week in Japan. These meetings have been useful because they have allowed Japan to understand the developmental needs of the African people. And at this meeting were some African heads of state, the Secretary General, and the head of the African Union. What was surprising was that in some quarters, the meeting was seen as an indication of rivalry between Japan and China for influence in the African continent. And yet, also, more surprising is the report that a senior Japanese official had warned African states of what is being called the death trap being laid by China in Africa. Now, those who have been following developments about the global competition in Africa would have known that the death trap is like a mantra that is being used by those who are uncomfortable about China's penetration of success in its economic relations with the African people. African economists have considered this mantra a canard because they say there's not much truth in it. Some have said if there's any kind of death trap, it may relate perhaps to only three countries. It is therefore important that the African Union, in a joint study with the United Nations Economic Commission for Africa, to do a study as to what is the debt situation of Africa vis-a-vis China. You may recall that in the 1990s, there was a serious problem of African debt, what was called the heavily indebted African countries. But those debts were not to China. They were mainly to Western banks, to Western countries, Western commercial business, and the IMF. Thanks to the efforts of NGOs, the problem was resolved in the 1990s going to 2000. So that is a very important issue which Africans should be wary about. But what is also of concern is that if Africans move away from China because of the so-called death trap, then Africa will be in serious problem. One would have observed that China has graduated from what it was doing in the 70s until recently. In the 70s, in other words, it was dealing with stadia construction, office building construction, and began, of course, in the 70s with the railroad into Tanzania. Tanzam Railroad. What China is doing now is very, very essential. Infrastructure construction. In the three centuries of colonial rule, there was hardly any meaningful infrastructure development except for those areas which lead from the produce areas to the seaports. All the areas in Africa which had infrastructure, minimum though they may be, were in those areas of temperate climate which were good for settler colonies, and they have some. But China today is focusing on infrastructure. Look at Kenya. Look at the high-speed construction of railroad from Mombasa to Nairobi. And they are trying to expand it into other neighboring countries. This is what Africa needs. Even the free trade area, which has been agreed to, could not work unless Africa has major infrastructure development. And if one drives away China from Africa, who is going to develop infrastructure? The IMF and World Bank are not going to do it. They made it very clear that they are not interested in major infrastructure development because the thing is too expensive. So this is what one has to be aware of, that remove China from Africa, Africa will return to its day of no infrastructure, and not having infrastructure will mean very poor economic development. So the lesson that we should learn with this issue of debt trap is that Africans must learn to think for themselves and not be persuaded by those who may have their own interests when they float some of these ideas in the airwaves. If we do that, then Africa may be on the road for the first time in centuries to significant development in the world economy. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, producer Douglas Impuga, engineer Shaogang Chang, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say,
this is VOA News. I'm Jim Burr.